WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In the new book, False Papers, Andre Aciman writes about his life in exile. It's a sequel of sorts to his memoir, Out of Egypt, which was his personal version of the Exodus story. On this archive edition, we have an interview recorded in 1995 after the publication of Out of Egypt. Aciman grew up Jewish in Egypt. His great uncle moved the family there from Turkey in 1905. The family settled in Alexandria, which was a lively international city with people of many cultures living together. But the Jews of Egypt faced growing anti-Semitism after 1956. That was the year that Egyptian President Nasser nationalized the Suez Canal, and Israel, France, and England invaded Egypt to regain access to the canal. Over the next few years, Aciman watched other Jewish families get expelled from Egypt. His father, a prosperous businessman, was forced out in 1964 when Aciman was 14. I asked him what it was like to be Jewish in Egypt when he was young.
There were many kinds of Jews in Egypt. You had those who practiced, and then you had those who didn't practice. I was brought up in a family that did not practice. I was not bar mitzvahed. I did not know how to read Hebrew. A lot of my friends did. Initially, it was, I think, a very nice lifestyle for the Jews. They were totally tolerated, assimilated. Even the religious ones were totally assimilated. And they went about their business and lived very happily. Eventually, it became increasingly difficult. There had been some incidents even before 1948. In 1954, there had been a spy ring that was broken up, and a big scandal ensued. And after 1956, the Suez War, things became increasingly difficult.
When you were growing up, there were no movies allowed with Jewish actors or Jewish themes. So what are some of the movies you missed because of that?
Oh, we missed Ben-Hur. We missed Cleopatra. Many movies with Paul Newman never came because it was said he was Jewish. And as I say in the book, the irony is that Kirk Douglas movies always were shown because he was so prototypically American, or fitted the image of what every Egyptian thought an American was like. So they never knew he was Jewish, so we saw his movies. And so, of course, the way they reached their decisions was totally capricious. They thought that Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer was fine. It never bothered them. But they would sometimes confuse it with Golda Meir. So, and that occasioned some problems as well. But, you know, there were things that they thought they could determine which were wrong. But you were living in this crazy, totally crazy climate.
In 1956, during the Suez War, Israeli forces, French and British forces, attacked Egypt. How did that change your status as Jews in Egypt?
It changed it radically, overnight almost. Ever since 1948, the Egyptian forces had, you know, been defeated by the Israelis. And there had been some resentment and ongoing resentment, but after 1956, the fundamental confusion was finally put in effect. That is, you confuse a Jew with an Israeli. The supposition being that if you're Jewish, you're going to be pro-Israeli, and therefore you're suspect. Or maybe you're the easiest scapegoat or the easiest person to punish. We were, the Jews were as punished as much as the British and the French after 1956. Many Jews and many French and British were kicked out summarily with all their possessions confiscated.
Which side did you want to win in 1956?
Oh, I was too young. I enjoyed the war. I think I made that obvious in the book because it gave, as far as I was concerned, from this child's perspective, it was like an ongoing party that lasted almost a month. There were a lot of people in the house, and we were all sleeping on mattresses. So I was playing with my cousins all the time. It was like a big birthday party. When the lights went out, because you had to, you know, there was a blackout, it was always wonderful to just be sitting together with about 30 people and just wait for the lights to come back on. And it was very warm.
Which side did your parents want to win?
Undecided. I think they probably wanted the British to win because they wanted things to become as they had always been. And there had already been a change since the king had been deposed. So they wanted the Western colonial powers to reassert themselves in Egypt. Therefore, life would be much more comfortable for them. And they expected that to happen overnight. After all, who would have foreseen that the Egyptian forces, which did lose the war, but, you know, eventually there were other forces that became involved, who would have expected that the British and the French would immediately stop attacking Egypt and retract, or sort of recoil, or whatever?
After the Suez War in 1956, friends of the family, relations also, started to leave because they were expelled for being French, for being Jewish. Why didn't your family make a move sooner to leave? Didn't they sense that the climate was definitely turning against them?
Yes, they knew that, we did know that our days were numbered. In our case, the days numbered almost 10 years. Why did we not move? And I think you should ask that question to many other groups that stay put because they're caught in a sort of totally historically paradoxical situation. On one hand, my father was doing very well. On the other hand, he didn't want to go and explore similar business ventures in Europe. He was afraid of Europe. He was comfortable in Egypt. He didn't want to go to America. He didn't want to find out how much of a businessman he was, really, vis-a-vis the big business concerns abroad. Doing well in Egypt, however, put you in a paradoxical situation. If you're doing well and you leave, that meant that you had already tucked away money abroad, and that was against the law. So you're there. You wait until they take everything away from you so that you can leave. On the other hand, you don't want them to take everything away from you because that makes you poor. So there we were, trapped, as it were.
So was your family officially expelled?
Yes. We got it by... They call you and they tell you, look, you have to leave. You think it's a crank call, and eventually becomes gradually confirmed to you that, in fact, it wasn't a crank call.
You describe what the crank call... You got a series of calls that you weren't sure whether they were crank calls or actually the police.
Right.
What did the caller say?
Oh, he would... Sometimes if I picked up, he would say obscenities. And I had no idea what he was talking about because I was 13 or 14, and though I knew a few things, you know, certain other things I had no idea existed. So there were real obscenities that when I told them to my father, he would be outraged. But there was that, and then they were saying things like, what did you do today? Why did you go to this restaurant? Silly questions that just made it clear to you that you were being constantly watched.
How did your father tell you that it was time to go?
Well, he sat me down one day when I came back from school, and he said it in English, ironically. We never spoke English. He says, they want us to go. So I thought he meant they want us to go somewhere or whatever. And he said, no, they want us to go almost sort of in the intransitive. They want us to go away. At which point it suddenly dawned on me that we were being kicked out of Egypt. And I didn't think it was so bad. I mean, I was excited to leave, on one hand. On the other hand, I wasn't at all.
Your father asked you to do a lot of work to help the family pack and get ready. Which were the tasks that you were assigned?
I didn't have to pack. He was always afraid of being arrested at the last minute. So one of the things he had me do was take down telephone numbers in a little agenda that I had. And these were telephone numbers abroad in France and England and Italy. And I was, as if I got there and he was arrested in Egypt, I would have to call these people and they would sort of call government people in their respective countries and they would, might, release him from the Egyptian hands. But it was things of that nature. I was in charge of buying the ticket to go to Italy because he thought that very same day he was going to be arrested. Then I was in charge of selling the ticket when it became obvious that we might not be asked to leave after all. And it's a good thing that nobody wanted to buy the ticket because it turned out that that same afternoon we were, in fact, told that we were going to have to leave and that this retraction had been almost fictitious and perverse. So I was in charge of these little minor details, mailing or sending telegrams to all my uncles abroad telling them we were arriving. That was my job.
Was it good for you to have such important jobs to do?
Oh, loved it. I enjoyed it. It made me feel very much like like one of those characters in the movies who does all these almost spy things making sure that the family can stay afloat if the man of the family is taken in prison. It made me feel very important. I was not a kid anymore. And one of the things I like to show in the book is how when my father told me, please take care of these matters for me, I'm going to be put in jail tonight. I'm doing these errands, running these errands for him in the city, and suddenly I hear somebody calling me, and it's my dad saying, "Hey, Andre," and I turn around and it's him, and he says, "Look, where are you going?" And I said, "Well, I'm running these errands for you," and I'm almost disappointed, and I say, "Weren't you supposed to be in jail?" He says, "Oh, no, not at all. That was all nonsense," at which point, we go and have coffee together.
My guest is Andre Aciman. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1995 interview with Andre Aciman, recorded after the publication of his memoir, Out of Egypt, about growing up Jewish in Egypt and being forced to flee in 1964 because of anti-Semitism. He has a new collection of essays about his life in exile called False Papers. The night before you left Egypt, The family had a Seder.
Right.
Was it a night of Passover?
It was the first night of Passover. My aunt, Elsa, was the one who insisted on Passover. She was the one who wanted ceremonies. We were living now in her house. She was officially in charge of that house.
We should explain here that Passover is the holiday that celebrates the end of the Jews' bondage in Egypt. And you've called your memoir Out of Egypt, which is very kind of resonant with that. So here you are having a Seder, celebrating the end of bondage in Egypt, just as you're getting ready to leave the country, and you decide that you don't want to participate in the Seder. You don't want to read the prayers. You don't want to have anything to do with it. Why didn't you?
Well, the most obvious answer is that I had to submit to her will and celebrate something that was religious and I didn't want to.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I was old enough to realize that the total absurdity, almost farcical nature of this. Here we are, Jews who are in Egypt and celebrating Passover, meaning that they left Egypt. So it's one of those repeat performances that I think it's Marx alleging Hegel said that the first time things happen in history, it's tragic. The second time, it's farcical. This was very, very farcical in the sense that, we were celebrating something that had no meaning. We were not even supposed to be in Egypt anymore as Jews. But there we were. And I didn't really want to go ahead with this entire motion, which had no meaning. As far as I was concerned, I wanted to stay in Egypt. I didn't want to leave, and I wasn't going to celebrate the leaving of from Egypt. Certainly not on that night where I was supposed to, and certainly not on that particular night in history, which was our last night in Egypt. I wanted to stay.
How did the family decide where to move?
That decision was almost made for us. Who was the closest relative? The closest relative was in Italy. We had reacquired Italian passports. We had to stop in Italy. Somebody had managed to arrange some kind of apartment, makeshift and temporary apartment for us in Italy, so we went to Italy. It was very difficult. We spent 3 years in Italy, totally out of sorts because we weren't used to Italy, weren't used to life in Europe. We couldn't quite adjust to the fact that we had become not just poor, but extremely poor.
Your great-grandmother used to say, Jews lose everything twice in a lifetime. When your family lost everything in Egypt, did your great-grandmother's words take on new meaning for you?
Actually, it was my Aunt Elsa who says, you lose them at least twice. She had lost everything in Germany before coming during the war to Egypt to her brother who had made a fortune. Yes, I put those words there knowing exactly what the kind of reverberation they would have, because you don't only lose things once, you lose them twice, or at least twice, which means that you have to play out this kind of exile many, many times, not just in the history of a people, but in the history of one generation. And one of the things I wanted to make sure that people saw in my book was the notion that exile is something that is intimate to Jewish history, or at least the awareness of what might be called Jewish history, that you play out exile many, many times. It is part of you, and when it happens, it's not something that's sudden or unexpected. It's something that has been inscribed there and embedded there, and it's finally manifesting itself like a bad gene that you were expecting would show up. So nobody's surprised. You're just sorry that it happened at that point in your life.
You're a writer and you teach literature. You work with language. Your mother was deaf.
That's right.
And her speech was very hard for most people to decipher. And so I'm wondering how much language you learned from her.
That's a very, very troubling moment. In, it's an enduring problem that I have. When people ask me what is the language that I feel most comfortable with, sometimes I will say English, sometimes I'll say French, even sometimes Italian. But I know that in the back of my mind, I'm fundamentally, and I realize that this sounds very ironic, I'm fundamentally a nonverbal person. I've lived most of my childhood with my mother, though everybody was, of course, dying to take me away from her and give me the right influence, the right speech, the right everything, which is why I'm so aware of how people speak and the problem that it played in my life, good manners, good speech, etc. My mother is fundamentally a person who speaks very in very few words. She speaks a lot, but she speaks in very few words, and she communicates the most meaningful emotions by not necessarily saying words. They may be just the equivalent of sort of clicks and grunts and sort of vowel sounds and so on. And these are the things that I normally expect from her when she wants to tell me that she loves me. She won't say, "I love you," the way we've problematized these three words in our society. She will just say something that is a sound, and that's it. And good enough, and it means everything. And that's the kind of language I grew up with. I grew up with an entourage of people who were deaf. And they were deaf and mute, or deaf and dumb, whatever you want to call them. They were people who didn't speak. And they didn't even gesticulate very correctly, because many of them signed poorly. So that they really relied on gut feeling and gut interaction. It doesn't mean that they didn't talk much. They were constantly communicating. But it was non-verbally, and I grew up with that. So even here I am in an interview, I have this sense that I have to watch myself because I might suddenly lapse into this non-verbal dimension.
Does that actually happen to you much?
No, it never happens. But when I write, and writers, you know, always make a point of saying that writing is the thing that is the most meaningful to them. When I write, I'm always aware that I'm almost putting on an act. This, I'm not supposed to be verbal in the first place. So what am I doing writing these sentences? Which is probably, Nietzsche says something very nice, that certain writers are always dulling their tracks on the sand to avoid giving the reader any clue of what they were really thinking of when they wrote the sentence initially. And I always have that feeling when I'm writing that I'm constantly sort of buffing or scumbling my original tracks, because these were the gut language that they were written in.
There's a moment in your memoir where you're with your mother in the grocery and there's a blackout, mm-hmm. and you know that, you know, bombs will, you know, planes will be coming soon. And you're on the phone, I think, with your family, and your mother's saying, "Tell them there's a blank hole."
Yes.
And you say, "There's a blank hole." And the person you're speaking to says, "There's a what?" And you finally all figure out that your mother meant to say there's a blackout, but she can't really say blackout. And you're young and you don't know the difference, so you're saying blank hole. Did that happen to you a lot, that you learned language from your mother and the language you were learning happened to be words that really exist?
Well, it was corrupt language, yes, and it was happening constantly. And, of course, they would finally understand what I was trying to say, and they would always say something like, "Oh, the poor child, you know, growing up with this mother who can't even say this." And which didn't at all bother me, because I realized that my mother's speech was faulty, but I never knew when she was saying something that it was faulty if I didn't know the word in the first place. So I would repeat it, and I was corrected. And that, you know, that always reminds me of this. That's what I was talking about when I mentioned this nonverbal dimension in me, that, you know, I'll say things and I'm always expecting somebody's going to call and say, "What on earth were you writing about? This is absolutely sort of trivial or it's drivel. And how could you say this?" I'm sorry. I guess I must have lapsed in my mother's language. So it's still going on. And my attitude when that's why I'm a very easy writer to work with, because when an editor sort of chastises me or tells me this is wrong, I will immediately say, yes, of course, you're right, because this is not my language.
Well, how did you develop such a love of language if you were so uncomfortable with it?
You know, what they say about Demosthenes, you know, he was a stutterer, and he was a bad spokesman or a bad, had the speech defect or impediment, and therefore he had to overcome that. And one of the things that probably, because I don't know, is probably what I've tried to do is overcome this as best as I could by writing in a manner that would conceal as best as possible the fact that I have difficulties with language.
Yet, you know, you speak several languages. You speak French.
Mm-hmm.
You speak English. What else do you speak?
I speak Italian. I used to speak Arabic. I had Greek at some point. But, you know, I speak every language with an accent, and it's the wrong accent. So, you know, if you ask me which is my real language, I wouldn't know what to say.
What would you guess?
I would have to say it depends for what. If it's for scholarly situations, probably English. If it's to speak very dearly to someone, might be French. If I want to gossip, probably Italian. If I want to really, really say things that are from the heart and the soul and all that, well, my mother's language.
Andre Aciman recorded in 1995 after the publication of his memoir, Out of Egypt. He has a new collection of essays about his life in exile called False Papers. I'm Terry Grossen. This is Fresh Air.